are going to talk with the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Loss of the Foods We Love. Wait, what? We're losing those foods? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, I love coffee and chocolate and bananas and wine and bread. And I was intrigued and concerned when I saw the title of our guest's book. And we will talk about why these foods that we love are disappearing and what we can do to save them. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Simran Sethi, an associate at the University of Melbourne's Sustainable Society Institute and author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She's a former environmental correspondent for NBC News, anchored the PBS Quest series on science and sustainability, and was named an environmental messenger by Vanity Fair. Good morning, and thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. It's a delight to be here.
So what compelled you to travel six continents in pursuit of unique foods?
Oh, Joy, you know, I left everything behind to tell this story because it was like you, I didn't realize it was happening. I thought I cared about food, loved food, knew food, and I went to Italy to do research for another project, and the scientist with whom I spoke said, you know, we're really worried about the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And I was like, well, what's this thing that I've never heard of that is affecting not only esoteric foods, but the foods that I love, the bread, the wine, the coffee, the chocolate, the banana. And what I learned was that we are losing diversity in every component that makes food possible, from diversity in the soil to diversity in the pollinators. You know, a lot of us have heard of colony collapse disorder with the bees. You know, one third of our fruits and vegetables are pollinated. And this moves right up the food chain. We have consolidated commercialized seeds. Four companies now own 70% of commercialized seed. And it moves all the way through. We're eating fewer varieties of foods. We're, you know, experiencing less diversity in the kinds of foods that we eat and the kinds of foods that we grow. And that's really a treacherous way to build a food system and food security.
Wow, I know you wrote a whole book and we do have the whole hour, but why are we losing this diversity?
You know, there are a number of different reasons for this, but it really, you know, climate change, the changes that we didn't expect, as well as the changes we knew were coming through industrialized agriculture, globalization, we have moved toward efficiency and toward the kinds of foods that stand strong on store shelves and are high yielding in fields, and away from the kinds of diversity that we need. So if we run into, because of the way we grow foods now or raise livestock, you know, we run into a pest or a disease or, you know, a change in climate that we haven't anticipated, you know, that we have the resources to go back in to breed into these crops the traits that we need, drought resistance, drought tolerance, you know, resistance to certain kinds of diseases or pests. And this is something that seems quite esoteric and far removed, and also quite confusing when you're in the grocery store. It looks like you have, you know, tons of choice, but it's largely in flavor. It's largely in brands, and even there we're seeing a real consolidation. So, for example, I went into a Walmart, the largest grocery in the country, and counted off over 150 types, flavors of ice cream. And I looked at all the milk, I looked at all the yogurt, and what I found was 90% of those dairy products comes from exactly one cow. And we would never do this with our savings. If we had money to save and we were trying to secure our financial future, we'd never put it all into one stock, you know? But increasingly, 90% from one cow is what we're doing with food. So, you know, that cow gets a disease, that cow, you know, suffers from some, you know, rising temperature or some calamity, and 90% of our dairy products are wiped out.
Yeah, and are you saying like 90, the one cow is like one Holstein cow as opposed to different types of cows?
Exactly.
Yeah.
One Holstein cow, not literally one cow in, you know, the whole country.
Right, right.
One breed of cow is now responsible for 90% of the dairy products on store shelves. And it's, you know, it's simply unprecedented. We have certainly always in agriculture moved toward, you know, efficiency, moved toward what grows well, what has a good yield. But in this situation, we're really getting to a perilous point, and we're seeing it trickle down in all kinds of foods that we love.
Well, you may know that Wisconsin is America's dairy land, and we have Holstein cows dotting our landscape. I'm not sure. Please clarify, why are Holsteins a problem?
Holsteins aren't a problem. Mm-hmm. Holsteins are the highest yielding dairy cow. Mm-hmm. What becomes a problem is if Holsteins are raised to the exclusion of every other cow and of every other breed. Because if that one cow succumbs to a disease, then we've lost a tremendous amount of the food that comes from that cow or the dairy products that come from that cow. So the challenge for us is by taking away the diversity. You know, it's the same thing if you invested all your money in one stock, mm-hmm. you know, and that stock crashed, you would lose everything. So that's exactly what we're moving toward in food and in agriculture, and that it doesn't have to be this way. We have great diversity, you know, we have great diversity in everything from the bananas that we eat. We see one kind of banana in grocery stores. The world has 1,000 kinds of banana. You know, why do we move toward the one that was shelf-stable, that, you know, grew well, even if it's not the most delicious or the most nutritious? And now what we see happening with that one banana, the Cavendish, is the same fungus that wiped out its predecessor has now come for the Cavendish banana.
Well, and so we have Lynn on Facebook who says, we have lost the wonderful bananas that we had when I was a kid. The Cavendish bananas we have now can't hold a candle to the old ones that we lost to that fungus.
Exactly. And she's talking about the Gros Michel banana. Big Mike is also how it's known.
Big
it
Mike.
Was sweeter. It had less starch. It was a far superior banana, but the one that came in its place was a mediocre banana that could still withstand the journey, you know, and make it to our grocery stores. And that's what's happening with cacao that becomes chocolate, with coffee, you know, the varieties of coffee and the diversity that we have there. We are slowly losing all of this and moving toward, you know, we're not going to lose all of our wine. We're going to have probably the cheap boxed wine, you know, we'll live, you know, we'll figure out a way to make some decent, you know, mediocre wine kind of stay in perpetuity, but it's the good stuff. It's the best of the best with, you know, some of it has the highest nutritional value, definitely the best taste. You know, that's what we're losing. And I realized through this journey, I don't want to settle. You know, I don't want to lose these things. They are precious to me. We are defined by food in so many ways, and it's more than just what we put in our mouths, chew and swallow. And so I really wanted to look at kind of what this means for all of us to lose the most precious versions of these foods.
And on your travels, you were exploring five main foodstuffs, bread and chocolate and coffee and wine and beer. Why these five?
I didn't start there. I started with rice and corn and potatoes, and I was sitting, which are our dietary staples, right? I mean, at this point, 3/4 of our food comes from 12 plant and 5 animal species, and 95% of our calories come from 30 species. And, you know, I was going to go with the dietary staples. I'm sitting in my tiny little apartment in Rome, Italy, trying to write the chapter on corn, realizing I think Michael Pollan, in his book Omnivore's Dilemma, wrote the best chapter on corn. And I also thought, I won't miss it. You know, I'll be okay without a potato, but chocolate has been my every birthday cake. Chocolate was my wedding cake. Mm-hmm. Chocolate got me through my divorce. Coffee sets the tone of every morning of my adult life. You know, don't talk to me before I've had my coffee. I mean, everyone knows what this means, to meet someone for coffee, to celebrate with a glass of wine. You know, that stuff matters, and I wanted to talk about foods with which I personally had an emotional connection and then suggested to readers, now map this onto whatever you love, because that's impacted too.
All right, so what's happening with coffee? Why is my coffee threatened?
Well, coffee, you know, is largely threatened due to climate change, and so I'll back up for a second and say the way we conserve this biodiversity that we're losing from soil to seed to pollinator and plant to, you know, fish to animal is in three predominant ways. We save it in out-of-place ex situ collections, so like a seed bank would be a perfect example of that, but we save everything from honeybee sperm to cattle embryo. The second way we save it is in situ conservation in the wild, so preserving the forests and the wild places where the crops grow and where they're diverse relatives. We call them crop wild relatives grow. And this also applies to animals as well. But they're the kind of, if you were thinking of a family tree, they're kind of the out there crazy cousin that's a little to the side of the family, you know?
Yeah.
But when it comes to plants and animals, we might need some of those characteristics. We might need the disease resistance found in a plant that's been growing in the wild. You know, once we put it in a field and grow it in monoculture, you know, and strip away a lot of that diversity and a lot of that resilience, we're left with plants that are quite vulnerable. So we need the wild. We need the wildness. The third way we save it is in situ conservation on farm. The best example for me is heirloom tomatoes we find in, you know, farmers markets in the summer that taste nothing like what we see in the grocery store year-round. That deliciousness, that diversity, that beauty is available to us in every food. But the one thing that hasn't really been considered in large part by conservationists is what I call in vivo conservation, saving it by eating it. And what we see with coffee, because we, the eaters and the drinkers, are such an important part of this equation, when it comes to coffee, climate modeling has shown that we are going to lose those forests. We're going to lose those wild places. Some of the models suggest from Kew Research Center in the UK, that was done jointly with research centers in Ethiopia, suggest that we'll lose 90% of that wildness, which means we'll lose the diversity, which means ultimately we'll lose Arabica coffee. So that, I don't want that future.
No,
and I don't want to drink the arguably inferior version of that coffee, which is Robusta. And so so that's why I wanted to shed light on that story. I wanted to talk about the implications of the wild places. Every place in the world has what's called a center of diversity for the crops that we grow. For coffee, the center of origin, the place where it was born and came into being, was Ethiopia. You know, as I was growing up, I thought it was somewhere in Colombia, you know, mm-hmm. due to some guy named Juan Valdez.
Right.
But absolutely not. It's mm-hmm. Ethiopia. For the grace of Africa, we have our morning Joe. And for apples, it's China. You know, that every food has a long story and shows how we're interdependent on the whole world and interconnected to the whole world.
Did you say, though, Simran, that I can save coffee by drinking it?
You know, that's what I am asserting, that we have not been considered part of this equation. But I'll tell you, Joy, these research centers are struggling. The money isn't there. The one place that we get to exert our power is in the market. And if we start to ask, where does this stuff come from? Where is the origin of this? Can we find the taste of place? We talk about this in wine, terroir. But that taste exists in everything. And industrialization has taken that out. I had no idea, to go back to chocolate for a moment, that a chocolate that was grown, a cacao that comes from Ecuador, would taste radically different from a cacao that was grown in Venezuela. And that origin, that place mattered. You know, that the cheese that comes from Wisconsin is going to be very different than the cheese that comes from Vermont. And it's a whole set of factors that makes those tastes possible. And, you know, what I am suggesting is absolutely what you said, that we can save these things by eating them, that we can save these things by creating a market that honors and recognizes diversity and that seeks it, that reaches for it. So farmers are finally allowed to grow these diverse crops. So the land in which they're grown, the people I talked to in Ethiopia said the only reason people consider this forest valuable is for the wild, the forest coffee that comes from here. So by purchasing that coffee, we are creating a demand for that product, and we are indirectly supporting the preservation of that forest. Otherwise, it's being cut down. You know, it's being turned into plantations for palm oil, which is now one of the most, you know, dominant foods the world eats. And I, you know, I refuse to let that happen without a fight.
We are talking about the slow loss of the foods we love. Why foods and the crops that we rely on for these favorite foods are at risk, and what we can do about it. Our guest is Simran Sethi. She is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. So have you noticed any of your favorite foods becoming harder to find, or maybe losing their taste? Well, what will you actively eat to try to save? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about why we are losing some of our favorite foods. Our guest is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Simran Sethi is telling us why these foods are threatened and what we can do to save them. And we're welcoming your questions or your observations. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Well, we've talked some about what's going on with coffee and chocolate and but we didn't talk about beer. Now, I said that we are America's Dairyland. We do our share of beer production too, Simran. So what's going on with beer?
Well, you know, I wanted to tell the story of this loss through different foods that we loved. So with the beer chapter, I looked at the implications for changing tastes, and I traced, when I talked earlier about, you know, how we save things, we also save microbes, which is so fascinating to me. I mean, an entire collection of microbes fits in something that looks about the size of a keg. And I traced from the National Collection of Yeast Cultures in Norwich in the United Kingdom to what used to be the largest brewery in the world, Truman's in London, a beer that they were able to recreate from the 20th century by resurrecting the yeast. And if they would never have been able to have duplicated that taste had it not been for the stored collection. So we're able to tap into these things and rediscover tastes that we once knew that we lost. And for me, it was so symbolic because it was really about recognizing how food is so embedded in our cultural, you know, definition of who we are and our memories. And I think we all have that experience of having, you know, missing something that we once used to eat that maybe we used to find in a small grocery store or farm stand or something our grandmother used to make for us that we don't get anymore, or that the taste of it is very different now. Like the caller said earlier, you know, about the Cavendish banana. And so what I wanted to talk about was like this diversity right there in the soil, in the microbes that make these foods happen matters, you know, and it goes up from there. It's not just what we see, but it's what we don't see as well. So for me, that was a really neat process because it was also about saying, I love me some cheese. I can eat my weight in cheese, but I'm not a huge beer fan. And what I learned on this journey was that taste and expanding our taste and our range of taste is really about just being open to all kinds of things. And I have grown to respect beer more than any other beverage. I still am not a beer drinker, but I wanted to demonstrate that this wasn't just about what we loved, but also about what we were curious about. And beer has such a fascinating history. You know, there's some researchers at Penn State say, you know, we cultivated grain. We started agriculture for beer, not for bread.
Right.
You know, and really, you know, recognizing that beer was safer to drink than water, that, you know, it had all these nutritional properties as well, and that everyone was a little bit tipsy, you know, until coffee came along.
Right. You know? And we love our beer in Wisconsin, but we also are seeing a real renaissance of the small brewery making these, you know, small batches of beer rather than the big watered-down, massive, you know, light stuff.
Yeah, and that was a key part of this as well. Thank you for bringing that up. That, you know, this wasn't, some people were like, oh, you're just talking about the fancy chocolates and those expensive, you know, lattes. No, I'm talking about craft beer. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about how these changing tastes have created a hops industry that is thriving here in North America. We've actually discovered, I described Todd Bates, discovered a new variety of hops that's native to the United States. I mean, it's absolutely delightful what's happening through this movement, and it's simply about pulling out these tastes, looking at how that's important, that we don't just want to survive on, you know, Bud Light and PBR, you know, and that through that, the craft industry for beer has now surpassed the industrialized beer industry in terms of consumption and popularity, so that our changing tastes, you know, is what made in large part a lot of the sort of smaller batch beers disappear, certainly looking at Europe, but our tastes are what is bringing it back.
Yeah. Well, we have full lines, so let's take some calls, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. If you would like to talk about the reasons behind the loss of foods we love, our guest is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. And our first caller is Jane in Superior. Hi, Jane.
Yes, good morning. I'm lucky to work in the agriculture sector throughout Wisconsin, bringing local farmers to a strong, healthy agriculture. And one of the projects that we're having up here in Superior next week is being put on by University of Wisconsin Extension Horticulture Department. Julie Dawson has been creating projects, trials across the state between chefs and local growers to help them develop their own tasty vegetables to be grown by local markets for the qualities and needs that the chefs have. And she'll be up in Superior next week meeting with local chefs and local growers to set up a vegetable trial to do exactly what you're talking about, developing the taste that we love locally.
Oh, what a great idea! So the restaurants will be working with producers, and that's the farm to table movement, right?
Yeah, that fits in that category.
Yeah,
it does, but it's a specialized farm to table. It's really looking at what is the farm, you know, and is it one of those farms that actually cares about preserving some of this diversity, about recognizing the tastes of Wisconsin or wherever you are in the country. And it's so delightful, and I think chefs are also, I'm speaking at a chef's event next month, they're leading the way. They're helping us define, you know, and understand some of these diverse tastes, but I think that's also a part that had been missing from the conversation. Like, when you say eat biodiversely, what does that even mean? So in the book, I go through how every one of our senses informs our experience of flavor, what we call taste. And I provide tasting guides for every chapter. So I want people to sit around, grab a glass of wine, and start to discover these tastes. For each of the foods I cover, there's a tasting wheel. You know, what often separates the rookies from the pros is just having a language for it, you know. And you'll hear a sommelier, maybe, or even a beer aficionado say, do you taste, do you smell the citrus? You know, do you taste the hayseed?
Yeah.
Like, I just taste the beer or the coffee, you know. And through paying attention, through learning the language, I have been able to discover these tastes. But it just starts with paying attention and having access to them. And I think chefs help us do that very thing.
Yeah, wonderful. And Jane, you have a project that is bringing back some heirloom varieties?
She calls them the modern heirlooms. So the textures and the flavors that we've lost that aren't available on the market currently, and if the local growers are the ones that are interested in bringing those tastes back to their community, she'll set up the trials for us. We can do them over the summer and then have the chefs back to taste and see how we did.
Yeah,
and then maybe create that connection, like you said, between the growers and the restaurants.
What kind of heirloom varieties?
She's doing cucumbers, tomatoes, peppers, green beans, zucchinis, melons, things that grow in Wisconsin but can be tweaked to meet the needs of the local growers.
Yummy, yummy. So why do these heirloom varieties taste so much better, Simran?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that's, you know, we've moved toward this standardization where, I would parallel it to clothes. You know, a beautiful handcrafted dress versus something that you can buy, you know, at H&M. Not to say H&M doesn't have some lovely things, but that we are now creating things for standardization, for efficiency, and that taste has never, it's only now that taste is becoming a parameter. I love the fact that Extension is sponsoring this because, you know, in my experience sitting with conservationists, this is a pretty new venture to actually be concerned with taste. Yield has been incredibly important, how much of this will come out of this variety, you know, being resistant to drought or to, you know, disease, also incredibly important criteria. But I don't I don't pick up a tomato for disease resistance. I pick it up because it's delicious, and I want to taste a tomato. And so I think that consumers have been left out of this for so long that we are able to reinsert ourselves into this. All the growers that, you know, that Jane just mentioned, they can only sustain this if there's a market for it. So our role as eaters is incredibly important, and I want us to recognize our power. I want us to recognize the opportunities that we have, and that the joy, the elation that comes from this. The solving this problem is delicious. You know, it's joyful. It reconnects us to who we are. It's not the scarcity, you know, that I've had in my experience as an environmental journalist of put on the sweater and lower the heat, you know, walk. I mean, I love walking, but, you know, it's just this idea of, like, taking something away, and here it's like adding something to your life. Feasting on your life is the way to help participate and solve this problem.
Thank you, Jane, for calling and letting us know about that. We'll maybe do a show on that down the road sometime.
Okay.
We had another caller who couldn't stay but was making the point that we should not import our foods from far away, that we should eat locally grown varieties of just about everything. What about a very strict eat local philosophy, Simran?
You know, I would say I strive for that as much as possible, and that it's hard for people. I was referencing earlier, like, not seeing the diversity because you see, you know, 150 ice creams in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
But on a local level, researchers did a study on, they analyzed 50 years of data on what 98% of the world eats. And what they discovered was, on a local level, we are, as a result of globalization, we are seeing more diversity. So, you know, you might see a mango pop up in the grocery store in December, you know, in Wisconsin. I certainly, when I was in Kansas, I would see lychees. You know, it's like,
yeah,
clearly they weren't grown here, you know. And I appreciated the diversity. But what's happening on a global scale, the global trend is towards sameness. And what they have coined as the global standard diet now is wheat, rice, corn, soybean, and palm oil. And for me, what we have done is stripped away the agency of farmers to grow things that represent the best that a region has to offer. And we've stripped away the opportunity to connect to our roots of who we are. And this deliciousness that I was talking about, you know, I defy anyone. I would love any caller to explain to me why the Red Delicious is one of five apples that we see in the grocery store, when here in the United States, we grow 1,000 varieties of apples. We see five. One of them is red and so-called delicious. But why is that the case? Well, it's because they ship well. It's because it's now cheaper sometimes to ship them from, you know, far-flung places. You know, why am I seeing apples from New Zealand in my grocery store when we grow them right here in the United States? These economies of scale and these contortions of cost efficiency have really, really also compromised what ends up on our plate. And that is really about trade agreements and tariffs. You know, the pistachio industry, for example, in the United States is now dominates world pistachio production. And that was the result of trade embargoes that were, you know, put on Iran during the Iran hostage crisis. So it was specifically a political act that changed the shape of what agriculture looked like and turned, you know, California into one of the world's leading pistachio producers. So the reasons that we have such a limited diversity are multiple. But the way to bring them back is to first acknowledge that diversity is important, and then, you know, recognize its value and ask for it.
Yeah, I do try to eat as locally as possible and as seasonally as possible, but I still love my pineapple and my bananas. And I mean, I can have my banana, can't I?
You can. Absolutely. Listen, I'm not a purist. You know,
right.
I'm not. I started off my wine, you know, journey in junior high or high school with a Bartles and James wine cooler, you know, and a Bud Light. I mean, I'm not fancy. But what I have realized is, for certain foods, that preciousness, that diversity is really important to me. I don't want to settle for mediocre chocolate, even though I will cut you for a Twix in an airport. I will do it, you know. But now that I've discovered the kinds of tastes that you can find, I didn't even know this existed, Joy, a couple of years ago. The caramel and the nuttiness of chocolate from Venezuela versus the burst of violets and brownies and cacao and chocolate that comes from Ecuador. You know, these things to me are amazing. And I think people have discovered that in craft beer, but that can exist in everything. It's there in coffee. You know, a coffee from various parts of Ethiopia, specifically one area called Yerga Chefe, is almost lemony. The first time I tasted it, I thought maybe the milk that I'd put in it was sour. No, that's coffee isn't one flavor.
Yeah.
You know, beer isn't one flavor and one taste and one experience. And that is what tying us back to place does. It supports the local economy and it returns us to who we are. And I think that the reason I do this is because I want to support local farmers. But also, that deliciousness is like nothing else I've ever experienced.
Yeah. It's funny, Simran, you need to come to Wisconsin for one of our... In Madison here, we'll have craft beer and a locally made chocolate tastings. And so you have different chocolates from different parts that are made locally and with different beer that is made locally. So that's kind of good.
I was in Asheville last week and we did a chocolate and beer pairing. And it was absolutely spectacular.
You know,
why aren't we doing more of this every day?
I did bring up the banana, though, in part because, well, we touched on it. It was the bananas that we have on the right now are, for the most part, are just kind of tasteless things because they ship well. Is that right?
They were bred, and they were the ones that withstood that disease, Tropical Race 4. So it's a fungus that starts in the soil, and once it's there, it's nearly impossible to eradicate. And now, so we were, you know, I wasn't doing it.
Yeah.
Scientists and breeders were desperately trying to find a banana that could replace the Big Mike. And what worked, you know, what had resistance, you know, to the disease was the Cavendish.
Yeah.
Was it the best tasting one? No. But it shipped well. It could become the next commercialized banana, and taste didn't matter. You know, they were just trying to get a banana on the shelf. So we have an inferior banana that is now succumbing to a different strain of the exact same disease that wiped out its predecessor. So we're just one step ahead. Sometimes we're a step ahead. Sometimes we're falling behind. I mean, you may have seen the spate of news stories talking about the extinction of the banana. It's endangered. You know, and who would have thought that?
Yeah.
And it's not something, you know, you go to the grocery store, you see such abundance. You have no idea. I mean, I had no idea, you know, that farmers, I mean, this is wiping out crops in, you know, in South Asia. This is wiping out banana crops now in Central America. You know, the farmers are the ones absorbing the most risk. They're the ones seeing, and this isn't just relegated to far-flung places. Wheat leaf rust that we're seeing is decimating wheat crops. They're calling it the polio of wheat. You know, it's decimating wheat crops right here in the United States. The oranges that are facing, you know, diseases in Florida. I mean, this is happening crop by crop. This is happening meal by meal. We're losing this, you know, because of the consolidation of something like the seed industry that grows fewer seeds. We sow fewer seeds. On every level, we're experiencing this kind of crushing loss. And by drawing attention to it, I think we're still at this really great point where we can bring it back.
We are talking with food journalist, food educator, Simran Sethi. She's an associate at the University of Melbourne's Sustainable Society Institute. She is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of the Foods We Love. We're talking about how monocultures are threatening the foods we love and what we can do about it. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org if you have a question or an observation. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about threats facing the foods we love and what we can do about it. We are talking with Simran Sethi. She is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of the Foods We Love. And we're welcoming your questions for her or any observations. Have you noticed your favorite foods becoming harder to find or losing their unique taste? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Do you actively try to eat a diverse diet? Let us know your questions and experiences. Lynn in Eau Claire is with us. Hello, Lynn.
Hello, Joy. Hello, Simran. This is fascinating. This brings to mind what we Irish folk call is the Great Starvation. In monoculture, there was food sent to Ireland. It was stopped, and a nation was bought through starvation. And it seems like a real insidious geopolitical weapon to kind of promote the monoculture that we are seeing.
Lynn, can you explain what you mean by what happened to Ireland?
There was one type of potato grown, and the soil, it succumbed, not in the ground, but in the bin where it turned to a purple mush, and which, you know, resulted in people starving, a mass exodus, and it was used as a weapon against these people in that the United States sent relief. It was stopped in the ports of England and not sent on to Ireland. But it was the monoculture that, you know, that was responsible in, for, you know, for the fail of the crop.
Oh, talk about a threat, Simran.
Well, one, I cite that in my book. Thank you so much for bringing that up. The potato blight, one-third of the Irish population was dependent on potatoes. And, you know, this is a combination, like you so astutely said, it was the politics as well as the actual, you know, disease. And one-eighth of the population, about 1 million people, died from starvation. Like these things, we understand this happens. We know this has happened in Ethiopia. We've seen this happen in Ireland. Like we're not, this isn't a new thing. Yet we continue to create an agricultural system that's taking out this diversity, and we keep our fingers crossed and hope that technology will save us. And I think, you know, it really speaks to you. Last night I was doing research on Iran, and somehow or another learned that in Afghanistan, you know, Paul Bremer pushed for U.S. seeds. They destroyed as part of, you know, as part of the war. You know, we ended up destroying the seed banks in Afghanistan, and the only seeds that were made available to farmers were seeds that were from commercialized seeds companies in the United States. So seeds are meant for saving. Seeds are food, they're culture, they're fodder, they're medicine, they're straw huts, you know, they're all kind, they're used for everything, and textiles, and the idea that we would be able to inflict our will, and when I say we, I mean this is not just exclusive to the United States, but that there are ways to manipulate agricultural systems, manipulate cultural systems by taking away food options. And that's what we're increasingly seeing. I mean, the rise of processed food, the fact that now more people globally die from diseases related to being overweight and obese rather than being underweight. We're all malnourished. We're what Raj Patel calls stuffed and starved, you know, and that is because the kinds of things that we are putting into our food are not the highest quality ingredients. They're not the ones with the highest nutritional value. They are the ones that are the cheapest. But that cheapness is also subsidized by tariffs, you know, by trade subsidies. And I would argue that cheapness, that notion of affordability, really obscures the bigger question of why people aren't being paid enough to feed themselves well.
Interesting. So, yeah, with Lynn wanting to talk a little bit more about the politics of all this, are there public policy options that can help us save our foods that we love?
You know, I would say, to me, in my career, the most heartbreaking thing I have to suggest to people is write your elected official.
Yeah.
You know? And cross your fingers, especially in this political environment. But I really think we need to exercise our curiosity, and we need to exercise our power in the marketplace. And this has been said many times, you know, vote with your wallet. But this is an instance where we have a real opportunity to make a difference here. I mean, especially frequent local farmers markets. Try to seek out shops that actually care about the diversity. Go to a coffee shop that actually talks about the origin of their coffee and wants you to experience it. I'm not talking about a chain coffee shop that roasts everything to, you know, high heaven and then puts a bunch of whipped cream and you know, syrup on top of it, you know, so you can't really tell what the core ingredient tasted like. Look for the people who really want to bring out the qualities and the flavors of the foods that we love, because those people are the ones that actually recognize the taste of place and want to bring it out. The ones who want to flatten this are the ones who want everything to look and taste the same, you know, so it's really up to us to show that curiosity, to understand what taste means, to experience and want to experience those flavors. For anybody who's like, you know, that's not my thing, I'm a, you know, I have my same diet, I'm a steak and potatoes kind of gal, or, you know, I drink the one beer I like, what have you. You know, the way we get over our fear of old, of unfamiliar foods is by trying new ones and being curious, and we just keep doing it. And I would say, as a, you know, test example of one, that my life is definitely better for it.
Let's go to Bill in Sun Prairie now. Hello, Bill.
Yes, good program today. And I listen most every day. But I grew up on a dairy farm in southwest Wisconsin, in around Mineral Point. Mm-hmm. And we at that point in time had a very diversified agriculture with good quality products being sold, you know, locally, that sort of thing. And because of the pressure of cheaper food coming in, it forced many of those types of farmers out of business. Bigger farmers took over, started growing the large corn crops that we've got today, and, you know, that destroyed an awful lot of good quality food that was produced in this country and the people that produced it. Their children couldn't afford to stay on the farm. They left it, as I did. You know, I worked for 30-some-odd years in the Department of Agriculture. But anyway, my point is, I agree with everything that, the guest is talking about the problems. But that was a very big problem that that we just failed to pay any attention to.
And food prices...
Consumers were, you know, looking for that cheaper product.
Yeah, so that's part of the problem, Simran.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, and now the refrain is, from many, many well-intentioned people, you know, one in five children in the United States is food insecure. This is a real challenge for us. But I would argue, when we look at the fact that, you know, we're throwing 40% of our food away, and that, depending on where you live, at least one-third of the population is overweight or obese, that we're not doing something right. And if we look at what this processed cheap food has done, not only to the agricultural sector, not only to farmers, not only to the culture of farming in the United States, but to every single one of us who ingest those foods, this is not a win-win situation for us. And this idea that, you know, we need this, we need to be able to feed people, absolutely. But let's also look at the income, the wage gap, and the income disparities, and the growth, you know, of income for only certain people, and the kind of the bigger picture of why we ended up where we are. A lot of these decisions were made without our knowledge. They were policy that was dictated, that was created, that supported large agribusinesses, you know, but I would say now, like, I did this very deliberately in my book, and I'm not just trying to hawk the book. I want people to seek out any information they can. But once you know better, I think we have a responsibility to do better. And in this instance, doing better is living deliciously. So it's a win-win all the way around, you know. So
what about
see, I
the,
really,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Simran, though, you know, what about, I'm trying to, how do I put this? So some people, what about people can't afford gourmet chocolates and,
right.
And coffees and craft
right.
beers and cheeses that a lot of people, you know, need to just, you know, buy the food that is cheaper.
Absolutely. So, you know, cheaper or, you know, familiar, I would say also. I mean, it's a real push, like you said. I mean, you know, some of these chocolate bars are quite expensive. I would say they're very different than eating a candy bar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the confection is different. The experience is different. I am a chocoholic, and I can't eat in one sitting these gorgeous bars. I now treat them like I would a bottle of wine.
Right.
But more importantly, to your point, you know, what Colin Corey, the researcher who led the project in which they looked at kind of what the world eats now, said to me, which was so interesting, because I was a little bit worried when I started this research. I'd just have to talk about esoteric things, you know, like the squash that you never missed anyhow.
Mm.
You know, and he said, because what we now eat, this global standard diet is wheat, rice, corn, soybean, and palm oil, that anything outside of that is actually helping reshift the landscape. So he said, eating olive oil is now a radical act. So what I'm suggesting is there is a continuum here. It's a pivot in the grocery store toward what's unfamiliar. It's a pivot in the grocery store toward anything that's not soybean oil or palm oil. You know, it's a pivot in the, it's flipping over a package and seeing where something came from. It's flipping over a package and saying, you know what, I don't want the one with palm oil. Or you know what, I want to support the local bakery and buy that bread instead because it's more delicious, that money stays here, and I love that person. You know, this is about relationships. And I think that's really what's gotten obscured. We're so detached, many of us, from this experience. And, you know, the goal of the book is to simply reconnect us to what we love, to what feeds us, to what allows us to engage with and in the world, and to realize how wonderful that can be.
We didn't talk much about bread, and I, you know, boy, talk about, I love my bread, too, but what is the big threat with bread? You see bread all over the place.
We do see bread all over the place. We see it largely coming from a very limited variety, very limited varieties of wheat, And those varieties, right, the monocultures that make up our mono diet, are succumbing to wheat leaf rust. So we're running into the same problems that we've seen before. A lot of people are now looking at, you know, what are called ancient grains, you know, because of gluten intolerance. But there is such an extraordinary effort going on in wheat to preserve not only the wheat that's grown and the diversity there, but the diversity of traditions of how we bake bread. And to me, this isn't just about the loss of genetics. This is also about the loss of culture. When we stop growing it, when we stop understanding it, when we stop knowing how to cook it, and we stop eating it, like, we're losing a huge part of kind of, you know, what our story is. And I want to return all of that to the table. And I see these incredible movements, you know, and that show that we are and we can.
Yeah. And I can't make my own chocolate or beer. Some people might be able to, but I can make my own bread.
Yes, you can. See, and I can't make my own bread, but I could probably now make my own chocolate if I had to, but I wouldn't, because why do that when there are experts?
It's so good.
It so well.
Yeah, it is. Well, you know, we had a caller who couldn't stay who wants to know about a genetic modification of food crops and how that affects the flavors available, GMOs.
Right. So, you know, there's an interesting kind of explanation, and I know we're going to run out of time for this, but I want to say, you know, agriculture is genetic modification, and you know, we are getting very confused with this. Genetic engineering, recombinant DNA technology, where we actually put, you know, genetic material from one species into another, that's kind of what people think of when they think of GMOs. GMOs are a big concern in the United States and in select countries around the world. Europe, you know, hardly has any GMOs, and I'm using that term loosely because, again, it's an imprecise term. Mm-hmm. But I would say the plants that have been genetically modified, the crops, are for yield, are for insecticide resistance, herbicide resistance, Roundup Ready soybeans, for example. They're not made for taste. They're not made for nutritional value. They're made for yield, for having a very high yield, and that you can spray Roundup on all those crops and they will survive. And that isn't why I feed myself. That isn't how I wish to feed myself. So I would say it's important to look at what's vital for you. I mean, now it's such a ubiquitous part of our food supply, it's a little bit frustrating for me, but seeking out organic farmers, you know, if the concerns around GMO are important to you, seeking out the non-GMO label, the GMO Project has put that out. I think it's just important to recognize that the crops that have been genetically modified, not one of them has been bred for the reasons that I pick up food. And, you know, they've been bred for the ability to stand strong in fields. A lot of that stuff is feeding, you know, animals as animal feed and biofuels. It is not, GMOs are not feeding the world.
Yeah. So in our final moments, so what can we do today if we want to start eating foods to save them?
Ooh, joy. Go to a coffee shop, go to an independent roaster and ask for a coffee that you've never heard of before, or ask them what is the flavors of Costa Rica or Ethiopia? What do you have? Go to a grocery store and look at some of those chocolates and start to pay. Maybe buy two chocolates from different countries. Any chocolate that lists a country of origin cares about that country and wants you to know about it. So pick up two chocolates and see if you can taste the difference. That's where I would start. I would start, go to your local brewery and ask about the hops. Where did your hops come from? You know, what grain did you use in this beer? Just be curious and then be grateful and recognize there are many hands that worked very hard to get our life staples to us.
I can do that. Thank you so much for being with us.
With great pleasure. Thank you.
Simran Sethi, an associate at the University of Melbourne's Sustainable Society Institute and author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. She's also a former environmental correspondent for NBC News. She anchored the PBS Quest series on science and sustainability and was named an environmental messenger by Vanity Fair. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor and to Marika Suval for producing and directing this program. And thanks very much to you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, it's the Week in Review. We will talk with two political commentators from different sides of the political aisle about the top news stories of the week. That's coming up tomorrow on The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.